Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. The Vatican Secretary of State celebrates a mass of thanksgiving for the blessed John Paul II. Someone who served in the Vatican throughout Pope John Paul II's pontificate looks back to some special times. And we hear of the work carried out by the Jesuit Refugee Service in Southern Africa, which supports country programs in diverse nations with different realities and different needs. Today, Monday the 2nd of May, is a day of thanksgiving here in the Vatican for the beatification of Pope John Paul II. Before a large crowd of faithful, Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone, the Vatican Secretary of State, celebrated a mass of thanksgiving in St. Peter's Square, remembering the blessed Karol Wojtyła and his legacy of faith.
Oggi ringraziamo il Signore per averci dato un pastore come lui.
Today we thank the Lord, Cardinal Bertone said, for giving us a shepherd like Pope John Paul II, a shepherd who knew how to read the signs of God's presence in human history, a shepherd with a deeply rooted commitment to evangelize and to proclaim the word of God in every place, even shouting it from the roofs.
Dell'impegno ad evangelizzare.
And Cardinal Bertone gave thanks to the Lord for having given us such a credible witness who taught us how to live our Christian faith and defend our Christian values. And he gave thanks for having given us a Pope who projected the Catholic Church into the international arena with an unprecedented standing of moral authority. And finally, Cardinal Bertone thanked the Lord for having given us a saint like John Paul II. Every one of us, he said, whether from close or from far, has had the chance to witness the coherence of his humanity, his words, and his life. Among the personalities we have been talking to in the lead-up to Pope John Paul II's beatification on May the 1st is a close friend and collaborator of ours here at Vatican Radio. You will recognize her voice and her manner as she continues to review the week in the Vatican in our weekly program, Joan Knows. Yes, she's Joan Lewis, currently EWTN's bureau chief since 2005. But her experience as a Vatican expert goes back much further and includes 15 years with the Vatican Information Service, which is part of the Holy See Press Office, as the English language writer and editor. She has also been a member of Holy See's delegations to Cairo, Copenhagen, Beijing, and Istanbul, and attended conferences in Doha, Qatar, on Christian-Muslim dialogue and on the family, meeting with Pope John Paul II many times. I sat down with her just last week and asked her to share some personal memories of the Polish Pope.
I was blessed over the years from December 7th, 1985, my very first meeting with John Paul, to December 14th of 2004. Almost 20 years, and to be honest with you, I mean, I had 15 different meetings when I could talk to him, when I could speak to him. I even have one video of the two of us talking. When I was on the Holy See delegation, at this time now working for the Holy See at the press office, Vatican Information Service, and I was asked to go on a number of delegations, but in particular, September of 1995, I was on the delegation to the Women's Conference in Beijing. And the Holy Father met those of us who were in Rome and flying the next day to Beijing. He came around and spoke individually to several of the members of the delegation. I was one of them. And he wanted to be a cheerleader. Normally, he would receive a delegation after they'd come back and thank them for their hard work. He knew, having having had the experience in Cairo the previous September, 94, of the population conference, knowing the great difficulties that the Holy See encountered, he knew that Beijing probably was going to be an uphill battle, and so he wanted to be our cheerleader. And he was just a sheer delight. And the video, the funny thing is, the video, it's not like obviously watching him at a mass or something else. The video is like you intruded. Every time I watch it, I'm surprised. It's like you've just intruded on this little private meeting that the Pope is having with the group. So
why, what was he like?
He was very interested to know what each one of us did. And actually, he had been given the names beforehand. He knew that I was going to go as Navarro Valls' assistant for liaison with the media, with the press. And the American, later to be the American ambassador to the Holy See, Marianne Glendon, was headed that particular delegation to the Women's Conference. He knew who the individual people were and what we were going to do, which was very, very nice. And he just encouraged us. And I can remember distinctly him saying that, now remember, we are here for you. I will be praying for you every day. And if you need anything, just pick up the phone and call. And of course, I'm thinking, boy, wouldn't that be fun to pick up the phone in Beijing, call the Vatican switchboard and say, the Holy Father said I could call him. You know, we need his prayers. And he said, again, that there was a huge staff in Rome that would be following our every move and encouraging us along the way, and to know he would be praying for us every day. But I have to tell you, of all the different meetings I had, I mean, obviously the one I just mentioned stands out. My first one stands out for two reasons. A, of course, because it was the first, and B, because of what I said to the Holy Father. Now, I have to preface this with saying I had been in Italy almost 12 years to the day at the time, and when the Pope's secretary called me the night of December 6th, asking me if I could be at the Bronze Gates at 6:30 the next day to attend the Pope's Mass, I said, of course. And I was going to be leaving in a few days to go back to the United States, not just for a visit, but for a longer stay. Anyway, we go to Mass. It's like you're in a catatonic state.
This is in his private chapel
in the Apostolic Palace. You've heard about this all of your life. And all of a sudden, you're sitting there. The Holy Father's like 6 or 7 feet away.
There are not many people in the Mass,
no,
are there?
No, there probably were 20 of us or something like that. And after Mass, I didn't feel that I had truly attended because I was so fixated, of course, on the Holy Father, the main celebrant of the Mass. Hello. And I went out in the square afterwards, reliving every moment to myself and in my eyes and the beauty of the chapel and this the prayerfulness of the Pope. I saw that, of course, in years to come, up close and personal, and then other times just watching a Mass on TV or something. But his ability to pray was phenomenal, defies description. But anyway, after Mass, the Holy Father always received the guests in a small room, and he would come and chat briefly with each one. So it's my turn, and the Pope's secretary points to me, and he said, Holy Father, this is the young lady from the press office that I was telling you about. And again, bearing in mind that I was going to be on a plane for the States in a few days, I thought I'd planned this. I'm going to talk to the Holy Father in English. I understand he speaks English. So what did I say to the Pope when he shakes my hand? I said, Holy Father, I'm ending my life in Rome. And I did. And he puts his hand on my arm. He leans in and he says, Cosa? What? Well, why couldn't I? English is my mother tongue. Why couldn't I just said, I'm moving, I'm leaving, I'm returning to America? No, I had to say to the Holy Father, I'm ending my life in Rome. And if English is not your mother tongue, you can imagine what was going through his mind. Oh, this poor thing, she really needs my prayers. And so then I went into Italian and obviously explained what I meant by that phrase. And he seemed a great deal more relieved.
I'm sure he did.
Seemed a little bit happier that I was not ending my life in Rome. But so you can see why I said that is the first meeting. It is always spectacular, but could also be your 21st, to be honest with you. And they are always special. And I think of the many times before and after delegations. What is a special moment? I just told you one, the delegation at China, the meeting for the first time, but another wonderful meeting. my brother Bill, who died several years ago, my brother Bill, his amazing wife and five gorgeous kids were in Rome for about, in Italy for about 12 days in 2000. And I had written Monsignor Stanislaw, then Monsignor Stanislaw, now the Cardinal Archbishop of Krakow. He was then the Pope's secretary, and I had said, could we attend Mass or could I have a meeting? And he said to me on the phone, he says, but there's a great number of you, aren't you, like 12 or 13? And I said, no, there'll just be eight of us, you know. But anyway, he arranged for the meeting. And what was so phenomenal, I was the first to go and kneel at the Holy Father's, foot of this chair he was in. And then my brother Bill after me. And he looked, I've never seen an expression on anybody's face like my brother had. It was like almost catatonic. He couldn't believe where he was. And then my sister...
Where did it take place?
Oh, in a small room outside the chapel, probably actually where I think I had my first meeting. Again, I was the first one, and then my brother Bill. After I got up, Monsignor Stanislaw came over to me and he said, would you personally like to introduce your nieces and nephews to the Pope? So he brings me around to the right arm of the chair that the Pope was in, and then I introduced my five nieces and nephews. And it was just wonderful. I put my hand, I think it's just the gesture you do unthinkingly. I just put my hand on the Pope's elbow and my left hand, and then with my right hand I'd say, this is my niece Christy or my nephew Bill. And that was a great, great joy. And the intervening years I did meet, that was 2000, if I failed to say it was the Jubilee year. And in the intervening years between then and his death, I met him several more times. But the last meeting was just shortly before he died. We of the press office were invited to celebrate Navarro Valls' 20 years in the press office, so 84 to 2004. And it was December 14th, and we were all invited up to meet the Holy Father, who very obviously was very weak, obviously, by this time. And it had been quite some time since he had walked on his own and so forth. But what I did that morning was, before we went to the Apostolic Palace, I looked up online how to say Merry Christmas and Happy New Year in Polish. And, of course, I found the words, but I had to know how to say it phonetically. So I found that. I really worked hard. I wrote it down on a little yellow Post-it note, and I put it in my left hand. And I just kept saying it all morning so that it would come with ease. And at that time, that was when the Holy Father's head more looked down than looking straight up and out at you, right? So it's my turn. I kneel down. I shake his hand. And I said, which I can't remember now, I said, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year in Polish. And he actually lifted his head and looked at me and smiled. And I was just overwhelmed. And Navarro Valls said afterwards, he said, that was the loveliest thing that you could have done for the Holy Father. And I said, I just wanted to be able to say that. And then he did, the Pope handed us, each one of us, of course, a rosary, and I said dziękuję, which is Polish for thank you. And so how can you forget any meeting, whether it was in his prime, 1985, he'd only been Pope for 7 years, and 2004, he was only going to be Pope for several more months.
Joan, you knew him for so many years and you were there for so many important moments and for so many private moments, which maybe are even more special. I don't know.
Always blessed.
But what did he teach you? What did he leave with you?
Well, I think I mentioned this once before because it just came absolutely spontaneously. If this Pope taught us only three things, it was how to live, how to pray, and how to die. And actually, if I had to add a fourth thing, I would say he taught us how to love. I think he wanted us to love Christ, the reason for our being Christians. He wanted us to love the church. He wanted us to love each other as brothers in not just our faith, but he reached out to people of other faiths. And he just wanted us to love people for who they were, for their humanity, for their human dignity.
You'll be working hard this coming weekend during the beatification, bringing his memory to so many people across the world as well. What will you be doing?
Well, the EWTN crew is here. I will be obviously assisting them. Live coverage before and after the vigil on April 30th at the Circus Maximus, and then live coverage before and after the beatification. There will be many interviews with people who did have a big role in the Pope's life, for example, George Weigel and others. And then I'll be talking about some of the other stories that have not been told yet. And I've also been putting together stories from friends of mine. I've written to cardinals and bishops and priests and lay people who I knew John Paul. And I'm now putting those wonderful stories about his humanity and his humor on my blog. So I'm doing a few stories a day, not all of them because it'll become a book. So
okay,
we're working on that. Okay. You heard it first here.
Thank you very, very much, Joan.
Conflict, of course, is one of the main reasons people flee from their countries. They flee the violence that is implicit in war, the persecution it is often accompanied by, the situation of social and economic unrest that makes it impossible to work, to learn, to find medical help if necessary. The Jesuit Refugee Service, JRS for short, is an international Catholic organization with a mission to accompany, to serve, and advocate on behalf of refugees and other forcibly displaced persons. Founded in 1980, JRS undertakes services at a national and a regional level, with programs in 51 countries across the globe. Its aims are to provide assistance to refugees in camps and cities, to individuals displaced within their own countries, to asylum seekers in cities, and to those held in detention centres. The main areas of work are in the field of education, emergency assistance, healthcare, livelihood activities, and social services. At the end of 2010, I learnt that more than 500,000 individuals were direct beneficiaries of JRS projects. One of the 10 geographic regions of JRS is Southern Africa, which supports country programs in diverse nations with different realities and different needs. I got the chance to find out more about the work of JRS in a region that I'm specially close to when a meeting was held here in Rome for JRS officers worldwide, and the Southern Africa representative at the meeting agreed to come into the radio to speak to me about her work.
My name is Robin Leslie, and I'm the Regional Advocacy and Communications Officer for the Jesuit Refugee Services Southern Africa.
Is it a big office in Southern Africa?
It's quite a small regional office in terms of its support staff, but we operate in 5 countries in the region, so we do have quite a few projects around the countries in the region.
It's also an area of the world which sees a lot of migrations.
Absolutely. Right? It's a complicated region. Very complex refugee situations, basically due to the nature of movement. There's a lot of cyclical migration, a lot of circular movements. People don't just come once and stay. Particularly in cases like Malawi, we have a lot of refugees that come from the Horn and use Malawi as sort of a meeting point or a destination before the ultimate destination, which is, of course, South Africa, where there's a bigger economic and social community pull. We have a lot of Ethiopians that come and stay in Zaleka maybe for 2 weeks and then skip the border down to South Africa, where there's a lot of well-developed community networks for people from the Horn. So it's more of a regional migration movement that we're trying to map rather than people coming from Congo to Malawi 7 years stay. So that makes it quite a complicated situation.
You were saying earlier there are 5 countries, if I'm not mistaken,
yes,
that receive your services.
One of our most complex operations is in South Africa, where we have 3 offices. We run an urban refugees project in Pretoria and in Johannesburg, and then we have an aid for Zimbabweans program up in Makado, which is a small town on the border of South Africa and Zimbabwe. Then we also run projects in Angola. In Angola, we deal with what we used to deal with was advice to refugees and asylum seekers. But now that war's ended, there's a lot of repatriation going on. So we're helping with integration and repatriation issues there. In Malawi, we have quite a complex project also in Zaleka refugee camp, where we are the main implementing partner for the UNHCR, and we're in charge of education. So we run a lot of secondary and primary education initiatives, as well as vocational training in terms of sewing, carpentry, computer courses, and those kind of things.
So you tackle the emergency, but you also do long-term development work.
Okay. Yeah.
And you work in collaboration with UNHCR?
We do. Particularly in our camp projects, we work as implementing partners of the UNHCR. So also in Zimbabwe, our project there in Tongagara refugee camp south of Matari, we work in collaboration with the UNHCR there, providing vocational training in terms of sewing and sewing classes for men and women, as well as computer classes.
I was reading on the website that your office won an award recently.
It did. We're very proud of that.
An award for video on refugee rights. And the catchphrase was, "Don't let ignorance threaten our humanity."
Yes. The situation with that video was, the VUCA Awards is a South African initiative whereby it encourages people in broadcasting and advertising to give their time for free to an NGO or a charity that requires a bit of a boost in terms of knowledge about what they do and their projects. So JRS was approached by the University of Pretoria, some film students based there, and we were asked if it would be all right if they did a VUCA submission for our work in JRS South Africa. So, of course, we said, yes, please, that sounds wonderful. And this is what they produced, and it will be broadcast on digital satellite television in South Africa at prime time.
Shall be the policy of this nation.
It's very interesting because it shows the world that even in places like Southern Africa, where so many people have been marginalised, the culture of marginalisation continues in a certain
way. Absolutely. And I think that's what makes the Southern African region definitely not unique by global standards, but very different from the situation in Europe, whereby there's very complex levels of integration that need to happen. In Europe, you have refugees coming in who are, you know, to use a colloquial phrase, the bottom of the food chain. There is really no one more destitute than them, due to a whole range of welfare state initiatives in places like the UK. In South Africa, there's a lot of destitution and poverty within our own populations. So integration and acceptance and knowledge about the situations faced by these people is quite tricky.
Just recently, the Pope for the World Day for Migrants and Refugees wrote a very strong, a powerful letter. He called it One Human Family, which is really the message that he's trying to get across, and that I think people like yourselves
Absolutely.
Are as well.
I think a lot of our projects focus on integration, particularly in our Zimbabwe refugee camp work, Tongagara, and in South Africa. We have a strong integration focus. We run a series of projects called Income Generation Initiatives, whereby we encourage refugees to approach us with small business ideas. And we really try to emphasize the positive impact that a refugee can have on their host or local community's economy. We're really trying to advertise this as a positive contribution, energizing local economies. Some of our refugees that run hair salons employ South Africans. So we're really trying to focus on integration.
Are things
in
a little bit better? There were some nasty episodes about 3 years ago, in which especially the Zimbabweans, I think, were targeted.
I think the problem with xenophobia in South Africa is that our global audience seems to think it's flashpoints. In actual fact, xenophobia is a constant low-grade aggression against foreign nationals in South Africa, and that's the reality. And what is important to understand in terms of our xenophobic attitudes is that it's not always about South Africans having a racist attitude to foreigners. It's about South Africans being frustrated by a lack of service delivery and a political power vacuums, particularly at the local governance level, and looking to the most vulnerable as a scapegoat for their frustrations. So it's really a more complex, more structural issue than simply changing people's attitudes towards foreigners. It's really more about addressing structural issues that push communities to breaking points.
You work in a very complex situation. You have the pain of the people you work with, you have the underaged, the widows, the orphans, but you also have a more of a global view of the situation. What is your feeling for a nearish future? What is your hope? What can transform the situation?
I think there's a global movement towards the recognition of complex humanitarian situations that involve refugees and migrants. There's a move towards wanting to gain a better understanding of what it means to be an urban refugee outside of a camp setting, living in an urban area, undocumented, without access to your rights or services such as education and healthcare. And I think that once, as long as there's a movement towards recognizing and research to better understand these situations, there's a real potential for helpful solutions to come out of a global discussion. JRS is taking the issue of urban refugees to the United Nations NGO consultations in June, and we really hope to move forward on that.
It must be a very rewarding work to do. You sound reasonably positive.
Yes, I think in no situation is there no hope. There's always hope, and I think that's something that JRS focuses on, and we focus on positive messages and trying to empower people and accompany refugees to empower themselves. And small successes can only be magnified into big successes as long as they're supported and encouraged. So, yeah, we are positive.
And what about you? How did you end up doing what you're doing? It's a special vocation.
I went to King's College to do my master's in international conflict, and from there I worked with a legal charity that was assisting refugees and asylum seekers coming into London, particularly, and the UK overall. And we worked with quite a few Zimbabwe clients. I was doing human rights research for a large portion of the Africa and Middle East clients. And I think it really just showed the urgency of the situations, and the plight of persecution is one of the worst in the world. And it's if you were going to devote your time and energy to something, devoting it to the assistance of those who are persecuted is a worthwhile cause.
And we all know persecuted people. I mean, they're on our doorsteps, whatever city we inhabit.
Yeah, and I think that's been really interesting, is looking at how those who are persecuted and are recognized legally, as in defined by the Refugee Convention, and those that are persecuted that fall into the gaps, the legal gaps. I think recognizing those gaps and recognizing that there's a wider population that needs to be assisted is really crucial, and I think that's
what... It can make a difference of life and death, can't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
That's all from the English feature program today, and from me, Linda Bordoni. But we'll be back at the same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programs on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program. Laudetur Jesus Christus.